Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Well, as the candidates do try to valiantly sell themselves to Granite State voters, the ones that are going to New Hampshire, I should say, they often try to highlight their differences. But there is at least one thing they all have in common. Every single one of them, regardless of party, they all declared some kind of victory in Iowa.
I am so thrilled that I'm coming to New Hampshire after winning Iowa.
After I am done taking the oath of office, I am going straight to the Oval Office.
In Iowa, we came back from a 50-point deficit in the polls.
Some of the press said I did fantastically well. Some of the press doesn't want to give it credit. I think that we did very well. I didn't expect to do so well.
God bless the great state of Iowa. Tonight is a victory for the grassroots.
I kind of came away with that feeling. Everybody was a winner on Monday night. But clearly, that's not new. Politicians have been spinning their way through presidential campaigns since the creation of Teddy Roosevelt's bully pulpit and even earlier. But in his new book, political historian David Greenberg goes deep into the history of that spin. It's titled Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency, and he's talking about it tonight at Newtonville Books. But first, David Greenberg joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you. So this term called spin, in your mind, I mean, I mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. At what point in time did we see the birth of spin?
Well, the term spin itself is really of 1980s vintage. It comes out of those post-debate rituals where the surrogates for the different candidates would gather in Spin Alley, which became so crowded with surrogates it had to be upgraded to the spin room. And they would start giving us interpretations that everybody, including the reporters who were interviewing them, and the audience that was listening knew to be not entirely sincere. And so spin is a term that suggests, you know, the public, the audience is aware that there's a sales pitch going on.
That's charitable. I feel like spin is a very cynical term, actually. It's almost as if politics is so broken that they can say it to our faces. We're spinning this.
Right. Well, if you go back and you look at earlier terms for the same phenomenon, propaganda, you know, news management, yeah, which was what they used in the Cold War. Those in some ways are much kind of darker and more ominous sounding terms. What we get is, you know, Steve Pinker, the linguist, calls it the euphemism treadmill. We devise new names for the phenomenon because it has bad overtones, and then that the new euphemisms take on the bad overtones themselves.
Well,
but I think of spin as a more lighthearted, more playful version of the same thing that's been going on for ages.
Just out of curiosity, some of the previous terms, you outlined them in the beginning of your book. Publicity. I love how you mentioned ballyhoo from the Roaring Twenties. Public relations, press agentry, propaganda. Good old communication, right? And then comes the more familiar ones: news management, psychological warfare, public, which turns into public diplomacy, selling, advertising, packaging, marketing, and image making, and of course those from today, from the 21st century: messaging, branding, framing, and strategic communications. So yeah, we've seen it all, depending on the age that we live in. So take us to to how spin really manifests itself vis-a-vis the presidency. I mean, we talked about Teddy Roosevelt. We mentioned Teddy Roosevelt earlier. Is his presidency where we see a formalization of the White House and information management?
Yeah, exactly. Look, spin in some form is a part of politics. The ancient Greeks talked about rhetoric. Politics always involves putting the best slant on yourself, on your arguments. What's different with Teddy Roosevelt is he, as president, decides to use the White House to engineer social reform. There's a reason we don't remember most 19th century presidents, and that's they didn't do that much. Congress was the driver of policy. So by wanting to change things, Roosevelt tries to galvanize public opinion behind him to sort of force Congress to do his bidding. And to get public opinion on his side, he goes out to tour, uses the bully pulpit, has these new press conferences where he gathers his favorite reporters to spin them. He stages publicity stunts. He really develops this whole arsenal of tools and techniques that become the basis of today's kind of sprawling apparatus of spin.
Now, to be fair, you also point out in the book, very accurately, I think, that there was that shift there in terms of the personal magnetism and power in terms of connecting with the public in the presidency vis-a-vis Roosevelt. But this idea of using language in politics is as old as the hills, right? I mean, you even go back to the ancient Greeks and the very term rhetoric itself, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, Plato writes about rhetoric in one of his dialogues. He sees all rhetoric as bad because its aim is not truth. It's just conviction. It's just trying to convince you of something true or false. But Aristotle comes along and says, no, you know, rhetoric can be used for good or ill. We shouldn't damn the whole enterprise. And I think today we kind of fancy ourselves Platonists. We denounce spin and the spin doctors and the consultants and the rhetoric. But deep down, we're really Aristotelians, and we actually celebrate spin, or we like it or applaud it, when it's in the service of a candidate or a cause that we actually support.
That seems very human to me.
Absolutely.
If limited, but very human. Listeners, we're talking with David Greenberg. He's a historian of American politics, and his new book is Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency. He's going to be talking about it tonight at Newtonville Books. So what's your take on political spin, where we find ourselves now vis-a-vis information management and how we got here? Do you agree with David Greenberg that maybe we shouldn't be so cynical about spin? Or do you think, as I may have shown my hand a little earlier, that politics may be so broken that it's hard to trust whatever politicians say? And what impact has this management of image and information and language vis-a-vis the presidency and politics actually had on our democracy? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK to get your spin on this conversation. David Greenberg, let me ask you, so after Teddy Roosevelt, how does this industry of information management then evolve?
Right. Well, Republic of Spin, the book, really has three strands to it. One is what each of the presidents do, and each of these presidents has certain innovations, steps forward. Woodrow Wilson, for example, during World War I, has the first kind of wartime information or propaganda bureau. And I trace this up through Obama and his White House Twitter feed and videographer. Then I talk about the spin doctors who were there early on the scene. They weren't called that, but you know, Warren Harding uses this leading advertising man, Albert Lasker, to help sell him in 1920. Edward Bernays, the father of American public relations, is advising Coolidge and Hoover. And the third strand of the book is about the critics, intellectuals, writers, journalists, who, as you say, tried to assess the impact of spin, these various new developments, radio, polling, etc., on democracy itself. So this question about what has been the effect of these communications technologies and spin on democracy is also one that goes back at least 100 years that I trace in the book.
Yeah. So let's talk about those spin doctors a little bit more for just a second, because so many of them, actually, their names are almost as well known as the presidents that they served. I'm thinking, well, David Axelrod recently with Obama, Lee Atwater going a little further back. Who are a couple others?
Well, Roger Ailes.
Roger Ailes, of course.
As a spin doctor and
for Nixon,
becomes a,
right?
a network executive, exactly.
So remind us what he did for President Nixon.
Well, Ailes is a fascinating story because he begins as a TV producer for the Mike Douglas Show, and in the 1968 campaign really convinces Nixon of the necessity of using television. Nixon kind of thinks of TV as a gimmick, and Ailes shoots back at him, TV is not a gimmick. This is your route to the presidency, essentially. And so the 1968 campaign was very expertly managed in terms of the limited number of images of Nixon that the nightly news shows could have, so that they wouldn't have all these unflattering pictures of Nixon sweating,
right,
and sort of snarling around that had hurt him in previous campaigns. Ailes then parlays that into a very successful career as a consultant through George Bush's 1988 race before going back to television.
And founding Fox News, as we mentioned earlier. Now, what about times where spin actually was essential to advancing policies or historical moments that we now look back on as very, very positive. I mean, because you raise a couple examples in the book, like when President Reagan stood in front of the Brandenburg Gate and said, you know, tear down this wall.
Yeah, exactly. One of the points I make in the book is that although it's certainly true, we can all agree that spin is used for misleading, and we don't need to applaud that. It's also the case that spin is used for leading. And whether it's Reagan saying tear down this wall or John F. Kennedy's inspiring inaugural address or many of these other great speeches and moments, they were all done with the assistance of pollsters and image makers and speech writers. So it's not like it sprang full blown from the head of Kennedy or Reagan. In the case of Reagan and the tear down this wall, you know, his rhetoric of standing up tough to the Soviet Union, even as he was also embracing Gorbachev and trying to achieve arms control, was a very important component of his ability to sort of maintain the trust of Americans to cut those very important nuclear deals that helped bring on an easing of relations between the superpowers.
Yet on the other hand, though, we also have many examples of when it seems as if a White House, image makers and managers really overestimated their ability to influence what the public thought. I mean, you know, the one that really pops to mind from recent history is President Bush's now infamous mission accomplished moment on the USS Abraham Lincoln. Right?
Well, that's a great example because it also shows that the power of images and the power of words cannot be completely controlled by the spin doctors, the consultants, the politicians themselves. In the spring of 2003, that image was, you know, political gold. And when Democrats dared to criticize Bush for that stunt on the aircraft carrier, Republicans and pundits said, keep complaining so we can re-air the same footage. It'll help him in the election. But come that fall, when the Iraq war had taken a turn for the worse, Bush was vulnerable. Time magazine runs a cover, mission accomplished, And Wesley Clark, running for president, makes fun of Bush for prancing around an aircraft carrier in a flight suit. So this very same image that was crafted with an eye toward political success because of changing conditions becomes a damaging image.
And I mean, so that in and of itself is a lesson of the limits of spin.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things the book argues. Not that spin is never effective or there's no point to it, but that it's not a magic bullet. That I talk about the first ever political consultants, a team named Whitaker and Baxter, and they are feared for developing what's called the push button technique, that their methods will somehow, you know, render a perfect campaign where we can be convinced of anything. And that kind of fear of spin, fear of publicity propaganda, has pervaded our history, but it's never really been all that powerful.
No, I mean, so sticking with the Bush example for just a moment, like, I mean, was that a failed one simply because, even though I take your point that at the time, in the moment, it was hard to push back against that imagery, but it ended up being seen as pretty ham-fisted, right? I mean, it was an overreach, over-arrogant maybe even. But what about the times where the public doesn't even know it's being spun?
Right. Well, there are lots of examples of sort of spin backfiring where kind of that image seems just too contrived, too phony, and the public senses that and rebels. There are times where we don't know all that's gone into it, and I think there it's not so much spin as secrecy. So, for example, the selling of the Iraq War in the first place, there was a lot of intelligence and information that wasn't ever fully aired, so the public didn't have enough of a basis for criticizing or judging the administration's spin. There was a lot of, well, we just have to take their word for it kind of thinking. And I think that was sort of the primary reason for the public's willingness to accept the administration's case for war.
I mean, we look back on that, on, for example, Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations, where he had essentially that PowerPoint presentation behind him showing fuzzy pictures that he claimed were trucks hauling WMDs across the desert in Iraq. I mean, that was, to be perfectly honest, now again, and I'm 2020 hindsight, but as cynical spin as you could get, right?
Yeah. On the other hand, there was plenty of counter spin. And for Americans who were paying attention and reading certain columnists and reading certain news articles. There were lots of experts who were saying those aluminum tubes that were allegedly for nuclear programs were no such thing. There were experts who questioned the claims about, you know, Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein having contacts in Prague. So there was information available. And one thing about an open society like ours, as opposed to a totalitarian society, is that presidential spin or information coming from the government is almost always met with counterspin from Congress, from the opposing party, from the media. So the public's challenge is to sort it all out, but it's not that we're being force-fed a single line.
Now, let's talk for a minute about Barack Obama just for a second, because he doesn't escape your microscope either. I mean, you write about his 2008 run for president and the image. I mean, like, they were masterful image makers for Obama as the spin of no spin.
Right. That's what I call the spin of no spin. The other term we hear a lot this election, but also in 2008, was authenticity, right? Because of all this spin that has been built up, again, as I show in the book, from Theodore Roosevelt through Franklin Roosevelt, even Eisenhower, Truman, presidents we don't necessarily associate with spin, today we're living in a world where we see it everywhere in our campaigns. I mean, the montage you played at the beginning, we all know this is going on. So the public craves someone who doesn't do it, who's just speaking from the heart, telling it like it is. McCain in 2008 has his bust, the
Straight Talk Express. Yeah.
And Obama is saying we need, you know, less spin, more straight talk. Of course, everybody knows that that too is you know, a line that is something that is devised with the help of consultants. A couple years later, when Obama takes his famous shellacking in the 2010 off-year elections, he explains to the New York Times, well, the reason we're doing badly this year is I didn't recognize the importance of selling my policies of marketing and PR. So he's actually saying not that we need less spin, but more.
Okay, so let me ask you, and I might come back to this question in a couple different ways, because I still think in the gut of many an American, they just don't like the idea or the notion of spin. Like, you just said it, like, people want straight talk. But from what I'm hearing you say, it seems as if political language by definition is always going to be spin.
Exactly. I mean, I talk about these critics and intellectuals who are kind of critiquing the system. One of them I write about is the German-American philosopher Hannah Arendt, who in the 1960s writes an essay on lying in politics. And, you know, she's not making apologies for lying. She's against Johnson and the Vietnam War and the deceptions involved. But she also points out, she says something to the effect, you know, since when have the truth and politics ever been on good terms with each other? That the political realm, it has always been kind of shot through with, you know, if not outright lying, grazing the truth, as Woodrow Wilson called it, shading things, putting forward partial arguments. It would be very peculiar for a president to get up, give a speech from the Oval Office for 20 minutes saying why we should go to war, followed by 20 minutes of argument for why we shouldn't, and then say those are the two arguments, you decide. Politicians advocate. They take a side, and they arrange the facts in a way to support their positions.
Okay, so I mean, speaking of people who've written about it, one of my favorites is George Orwell, of course, Politics in the English Language, his famous essay where he basically says all political language is going to be as weightless as the wind. I mean, it's hard, though. I take your point that politics is persuasion, and therefore it's language, and therefore it's persuasion that has to both have an impact on us intellectually and emotionally, so therefore it will be spin. But can we envision a politics where there's less selling that has to be that's involved to the public, and more I don't know, frank and honest dialogue?
Well, we do have a no spin zone. You know, it's hosted by Bill O'Reilly, who is not people's idea of the most sort of dispassionate commentator. Of course, the ideal is very admirable and desirable. In practice, you know, politicians are not going to be the Associated Press. They're not going to give us sort of the most neutral version of events. And so the challenge, I think, is not to somehow weed out the spin from politics, but to educate the public to know how to listen to it and how to decode it and how to see through it. I think the public is actually pretty good at that. Sure, there are times where we wish there was more skepticism. But that overall, I think this is the challenge, getting people engaged to spin back, fight back, or unspin what's being thrown at them.
Well, in the book, you write that in a democracy, spin is how leaders make their case to a sovereign public. It's a way to engage, persuade, and mobilize the people in whom power ultimately resides. So is that your way of saying that overall, you don't think spin and its existence have been harmful for American democracy?
Well, I'm not saying we don't need to worry. There's a little bit of a paradox. Because of this anxiety about spin that I traced throughout the decades, it's actually we need that anxiety to keep us honest. So, yes, at times it's overwrought. At times, I think people are too despondent about the state of our public discourse. I mean, after all, in both the primary seasons, there are some very substantive debates about the future of the two parties going on. But that skepticism is an important element in keeping us aware, keeping us clued into as what's going on.
Well, truth or truthiness? That is the question, right? David Greenberg, historian of American politics and author of Republic of Spin, an Inside History of the American Presidency. He'll be talking about it tonight at Newtonville Books. We've got a link to more information about that at radioboston.org. Great pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Great pleasure on my part. Thank you.
There's more in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.